Hey, good morning, everyone. I think I'm going to get started. I see a Portland Seahawks hat out there. That's always exciting. So my name is Katie Krall, and I'm going to be presenting today on modern coaching in baseball. 2 years ago, I spoke with Dodgers Executive Vice President Janet Marie Smith and former Red Sox coach Bianca Smith about the future of women in baseball. And I think in many ways you'll see strands of that conversation today, but I also think that I'm broaching new ground and that the current revolution that's happening in baseball in terms of integrating data between the lines, it's really unlike anything we've seen before. And I think, you know, if any of you found yourself in a war room today discussing draft models, defensive positioning, you know, you're going to hear terms like leverage index, WOBA, outs above average. Now, finally, that's come to the field. And so last year, I was a coach for the Red Sox in uniform with the AA Portland Seahawks affiliate. And so I'm going to really use that experience to kind of mold and form the direction of what I talk about today. So I'm going to share a little bit about my background in the 7 years that I've spent in baseball. This, I think, is because the utility player that I've become really is a product of the different experiences that I've had. Then after that, I'm going to speak mostly about advanced scouting, what I would do during the game as a first base coach, pitch design, the importance of building trust and really forming rapport with players. And then at the end, I'll wrap up a little bit, and hopefully there's a bit of time for questions if anyone would like to ask anything. So there's this kind of like look of questioning that I get when I tell people that I was a history major. You know, like, how do you have a job at all, let alone a job in baseball, after studying liberal arts? But I actually feel like being able to piece together a narrative and synthesize disparate parts at Northwestern was absolutely fundamental for what I did, not only later at Major League Baseball in league economics and operations, when Dan Halem and Commissioner Manfred would ask me for 60-page memos on the potential for moving back the pitching mound, but also thinking about how do I tell a story to an audience and make sure they take away the key themes. So while still an undergrad, I planned the World Series trophy tour for the Cubs in 2016, so if there are locals in the room, it's a great year. So to be a part of that was really extraordinary to see so many different types of people, all races, all ages, like come together to celebrate that moment. That in many ways was when I knew I wanted to be in baseball and work in sports because of how transformative it was and the way that it could cut across cultural lines. After the trophy tour, I was an assistant GM in the Cape Cod Baseball League in 2017. So a lot of the players that you'll see today, like Nico Horner, Alec Bohm, all of those guys were still in college on the Cape in 2017. So working with them, thinking about roster construction for the subsequent season, infield and outfield defensive shifts. You know, you had guys who were playing at Clemson, but you also had guys who were at South Alabama. So how in the course of a few weeks do you make sure everybody knows the signs, everyone's on the same page for the upcoming season? So like I said, after Northwestern and the Cape, moved to New York, was there for a year and a half, and really loved being part of the macro initiatives at the commissioner's office, but I knew I wanted to be with the team, and I knew I wanted to have the opportunity to build a roster, to be part of something that could win a championship. So there was an interdisciplinary role available with the Reds in baseball operations, scouting and analytics, and it felt like a really unique way to cut my teeth at a club. So packed up, moved from New York to Cincinnati. Bit of a culture shock, but really enjoyed it, and the Reds were super successful in both of our seasons. We made the playoffs in 20 and then just missed it in 21 because the Cardinals went on that historic win streak. While at the Reds, I also earned my MBA part-time from the University of Chicago, and through a classmate was connected with some folks at Google on the global strategy team. Was at Google for a whopping 2 months, and then the Red Sox called and said, hey, we're hiring in-uniform coaches at all of our minor league affiliates. Would you want to wear baseball pants for the first time since elementary school? And I said, absolutely, sign me up. So that's my background. I'm now currently at Hawkeye, and then I'll be a professor at Northwestern teaching sports economics this fall. And my twin sister, who's over there taking too many photos, is also faculty at Northwestern. When I gave her a rundown of the presentation, she said, you know, one of my biggest takeaways is the parallels between coaching and teaching. And I think that really stuck out to me, and I think you'll see that, especially in the section on building trust and empathy and the importance of soft skills, they really are kind of mirror roles in some ways. Okay, that's everything about me, I promise. So advanced scouting. Advanced scouting has been part of the game since its inception, right? Whether it was Connie Mack or John McGraw or even Hack Wilson, like you had players actively taking notes, being aware of tendencies, thinking about the ways in which they could gain a competitive advantage. We now have the ability, though, through data and through really robust video technology in order to do that on a scale that's never been seen before. So in the past, you would have a lot of teams who would have in-person scouts deployed to note the tendencies of their upcoming opponents. And so you would have guys who would put thousands of miles on their cars every single year. They'd see all these players in person because there wasn't video, because there wasn't the numbers. You didn't know that Carlos Rodon has one of the best sliders in baseball unless you actually went out and you saw it. And so that exists to a certain extent today, but far more so exclusively in October for the playoffs. So very rarely will teams spend that budget on in-person scouting for advance. It's more so, come October, we want just any granular advantage we can, so we're going to put a few guys on the road. On the left, you'll see what has now replaced those in-person scouts, and it's a lot of sites like True Media. This is a heat map of Jose Altuve and what he does in each count, right? So where does he expand? Where does he do damage when he's up 2-0? Where does he maybe chase when he's behind? So this type of information, right, is incredibly valuable. If you're a pitcher, if you're a hitter, you can know yourself, you can know how you're going to be pitched to. And so last year with the Sea Dogs, a huge portion of my responsibilities were running these advanced meetings, which we split up into position groups. So pitcher pregame and then hitter pregame. And there's a lot of information, right? Like you can look at this and think, oh my gosh, what are all the colors? You know, what am I supposed to swing? It can be super overwhelming. So I think one of my roles as a conduit was being able to articulate the 3 to 4 data points that you should pick, right? Like know yourself as a hitter. Do you just need to know the max fastball velo? Okay, fine, know that. Do you need to know the pitcher's extension? And I think having that training ground, so then someday, if and when the players get to Fenway, they're not overwhelmed when they're talking to Dave Bush or when they're speaking to Alex Cora. We tried to keep the same materials up and down the minor league system. So we gradually introduced it to them, but by no means then when they were in their big league dugout for the first time were they like, oh my God, that's a really scary rainbow. And it was super valuable, not only to think about advanced scouting, but also how to watch video, right? So like Kike Hernandez, he always wants to know when the pitcher is separating his hands because then that enacts his timing mechanism as a hitter. So learning how to watch video, all of those skills, they need to be developed. They're not necessarily intuitive. And being able to work with them was super fulfilling as they think about what they need in order to be successful at the highest level. Okay, this is the last photo of me, I promise. But last year, I also coached first base. And so I was the first female in AA to be on the bases. And so my helmet ended up getting inducted into Cooperstown, which was a really huge honor and super incredible. And so people often ask me, well, what is it like to coach first? And I said, I've got like three primary responsibilities. The first is remind the guys of the signs, because even in September, they still did not know the signs. Hold all their stuff until the bat boy or bat girl can come and save you from your armload of things. And then finally, pitcher tells, right? So a lot of the work of base coaches is far more art than science, in that pregame, you're looking at video, you're trying to determine, okay, does the pitcher flare his glove on the changeup? Does he maybe set differently? Does he set at his belt when he's throwing a fastball, but does he set at his chest when he's gonna throw a slider? So all of those things are super valuable and a huge advantage for a hitter. I will say it was definitely a mixed bag in terms of who wanted to receive that information and who didn't. So you would think that anyone would want to know, oh, okay, it's probably going to be a changeup. Oh, it's going to be a higher velo pitch. But in actuality, some of the guys had a really tricky time picking up the tells in the box. And so at that point, you have to have the feel and understand, okay, I'm going to give the information to Dave Hamilton, but I'm not going to go near Tristan Casas, right? So that also is getting a sense of who the players are, what they want, and how you can support them. When not at first, I was often in the dugout speaking with our hitting coach and the hitters about the pitchers who were coming in. So again, in those pregame meetings, we absolutely were breaking down the rotation, the bullpen, but just quick hitters when a fresh arm came in, they had paper copies and iPads which outlined all of their tendencies, if they were a fly ball or a ground ball pitcher, their usage rates, and then also there was video of each of their pitches too, right? So again, at that point, you almost set out a buffet for the players and they can pick what they want. If they want to talk about the strikeout, we can talk about the strikeout. If not, we're just going to turn the page to the next at bat. So really valuable, again, to be in uniform and to be in the trenches with them to have those types of conversations. Pitch design and player plans. So again, I think that anyone who has reservations or an aversion to analytics, the best counter argument I always provide is all of this has always existed. Pitch design has always existed. Sandy Koufax had a curveball that had a spin rate. We just couldn't measure it at the time. So historically, guys would play catch during spring training and they'd be bored and they'd monkey with different grips. Or they would know that they worked north-south really well. Maybe they had a fastball with ride and then they have a 12-6 curveball. Okay, I need something that can get me east-west out. I'm either going to develop a sinker or I'm going to get a cutter in. So all that stuff has always existed. We just now have really incredible tools like edgertronic cameras, like TrackMan, like Hawkeye, that can now honestly weaponize in many ways some of the historic practices. So with the Red Sox, we worked in concert, the analytics department and the pitching strategy group, about how to optimize those mixes. So thinking about if a player was more adept at pronation versus supination, that would determine our recommendations. If we looked at his two-seamer and we thought this is a really garbage pitch, we need to maybe change it or add a different weapon to your arsenal. All of those conversations happened in real time, and it was really incredible because I think, you know, when I shared my background, up to that point, I had always been in the ivory tower of the league office or the front office. And so then to be working with a player and to be a very, very, very small part of his career development and his professional development was really fulfilling. And so these conversations, I feel like, were probably the most fruitful of my time with the Red Sox. And then we would monitor the changes in horizontal, vertical break, extension, and then communicate that through message boards up and down the Red Sox system. So I think a lot of organizations will struggle with stereo coaching in that you're in AA and you're told, okay, only throw your curveball, and then suddenly you get to AAA and it's, no, we want you to develop a sweeper. And if you're a player, that's a lot of mixed messages. It can be hard to parse through, what do we actually want me to do? And so again, like being a coach and recognizing that players are not experiments, they're not just ID numbers on a spreadsheet, they're just not the outputs of defensive positioning models. You know, they are human beings who struggle, whose development is not linear. All of that I felt like was really valuable to learn and to be part of that. And so each month we would have meetings with both pitchers and hitters talking about their progress on these player plan goals and thinking about how they could develop, and it served as a forum in many ways for more back and forth communication. We never wanted the plans to be stone tablets that said, you know, you can't chase sliders out of the zone, you can't swing at the first pitch for every at bat. All of it was more collaborative and more of a two-way street. Okay, building trust. So when I talked to Annie about the presentation, I showed her this line. She said it was so boring. You can't just have a slide with text and no pictures. And I recognize that it is boring. So to add a little bit of color, I'm going to share two different anecdotes. The first, I absolutely adore. The second is really meaningful, but definitely represents a different side of baseball. So, you know, you're with these guys a lot, starting in spring training. It's 14-hour bus rides from Richmond, Virginia to Portland, Maine. It's daily Jersey Mike subs. It's Bad Bunny every single game in the clubhouse. You know, you're absolutely with them. And from that, I think you develop trust, but I also saw the onus as being on me in order to get to know them, right? Like, I don't look like a lot of baseball coaches they've probably had in the past. They probably have never really worked with someone like me, so I knew that initially I would have to make the effort, and I took that on, and I absolutely loved doing it. You know, I didn't come up to them and talk about seam shift and wake initially, or vertical approach angle. We talked about where they were from, or golf, or their favorite place for burritos. All of that, I think, then led to a comfort and a willingness to ask questions, because I think with a lot of this information, it can be really overwhelming, and even if you do read baseball prospectus or Fangraphs every day, you still may not know everything. So I remember one of the pitchers I worked with, Brendan Nail, who's a left-handed reliever, he came up to me one day, and he's like, Katie, I need your help with something. It's really important. I was like, okay, B, what's up? And he said, I have to mail a letter, and I don't know how to do that. I was like, all right. And I was like, what do you need to mail the letter for? And he said, oh, it's my girlfriend's birthday tomorrow. And I was like, okay, we're gonna get her a card, we're gonna get her that mail. Right, so in that moment, it didn't matter that I worked at Google, it didn't matter that I could help him improve the horizontal movement on a sinker. All that mattered is he needed to get the girlfriend the letter, and I was the one who was gonna give him that stamp. So in those types of moments, for me, it was just so rewarding and validating that I was there for a reason. You know, another instance, definitely on a different note, was we had a play ball clinic. So we had a bunch of little kids, and I complimented one of our outfielders who always took the time to sign autographs after game, like no matter what, pouring rain, 8-hour game, didn't matter. And he said, well, I know I have to do it because I'm not gonna be here forever. And so he said, we're just standing in center field, sits down and talks about his struggles with mental health. And, you know, I was not prepared for it. You know, it was just like a random August afternoon that he felt like he needed to share, and other people at the Red Sox had known about it, but maybe not to the degree. And so I just listened. And again, it had nothing to do with numbers, had nothing to do with data science. It just was a moment of him needing a teacher or a coach, just a person to listen to. And I think, again, like those types of experiences, they stand out for me almost more than anything. And I think when you can have players who build trust and who are willing to let you in, it means the world, because they're not obligated to whatsoever. Okay, so to wrap up, there's an individual on the left-hand side of the screen who used to say that those damn spreadsheets were ruining baseball. He was my godfather and the bullpen coach of the Minnesota Twins for 32 years. Definitely crusty, old-school Southsider who probably knew more about baseball than I ever will, but I think it's through him in many ways that I have such a respect and appreciation for the game, because he was so old-school and talked about like Blake Snell's mound presence in 2018 and just that kind of like institutional knowledge that you can't really glean from doing anything other than living it. So it was because of him that I wore number 43, and I definitely hope to be back in uniform again someday, because I think, you know, we may have disagreed about the spreadsheets, but we both were on the same page when it came to what it feels like to stand between the lines and to wear a uniform. Would love to thank Scott Carter, Scott Bush, all the phenomenal folks at Sabre. I truly love this group, and it's such a passionate community that is a privilege to be a part of. So thank you for letting me speak, and thank you for the time.
Connection, with your Red Sox connection, you have the very pro-analytic Bill James and the very anti-analytics Michael Wilbon. And I'm just wondering the extent to which you may or may not have interacted with either or both.
Yeah, great question. My mom, who's over there, adores Michael. She's also a Northwestern Wildcat. I think he's great. Again, I think that there is such a value in having, Theo Epstein always used to call it, like two lenses of the glasses, right? The quantitative and the qualitative. And by no means should you discount it. And actually, some of the most analytically driven or successful teams, like the Rays and the Yankees, they keep tons of special assistants on staff who are old school baseball people who then fill in the gaps that their models don't necessarily provide.
When you're watching tape trying to find out pitcher's tells, mm-hmm. Do you know the pitch that's coming before? Like, are you watching in chronological order in game, like in real time? Or do you have it separated, like here are the 73 fastballs he threw today, here are the 26 changeups, so you can see like, okay, this is fastball. Are the mechanics exactly the same? And then here are the changeups. Ooh, there's a slight difference now. Like, how do you literally do it?
Yes, awesome question. So I would say you try not to look at the pitch type before, because if you do, then it almost can become like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like, oh, it's so obvious. Well, no, it's obvious because you have fastball next to the true media label and you're just reading that. But I think, like, there are people, it's a gift. You know, there are people who are super adept at it, and then the tricky thing can be, which is something the numbers don't necessarily show, is if a guy gets shelled, I'm gonna guess it's probably in many ways because he was tipping. And so then communicating that to our pitchers, like, hey, you know, every time you were throwing your changeup, everybody in the ballpark knew it. And so working with them to try to combat that in bullpens so they're not necessarily divulging information that's going to be disadvantageous. Yes.
Did the letter make it on time?
Because
he said the birthday is the next day.
They're engaged now.
Really, because I'm immediately concerned that 24 hours is not enough time to get the letter there.
We expedited it. Yeah, thank you for asking.
Expedited it. Great. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
I got it, though.
As a first base coach, how much are you looking for tipping?
Absolutely. It's a huge portion of being on base. And then also disclosing pitcher time to home and then catcher pop time, right? So just doing the simple math of, okay, if this is the usual runner time from first to second, go on an off-speed pitch if you can. You have the green lights. Some guys had perennial red lights. You know, just being like very mindful of who could steal a base and who did not. Yes, Mr. Seadogs.
I was interested in how you were talking about how you involve the players in having these discussions and sort of bringing them into the process. Do you do that also by having them come up with pseudo metrics, maybe, or like describing their goals in a way that could be maybe passed up the chain or used by analysts to actually incorporate something that has been missed in the organization? Or is that something more that's more of a qualitative soft thing that's passed through you, through the coaching staff?
Definitely, really good question. I would say, there are metrics and there are things that I would bring to an analyst in a front office that I wouldn't necessarily say to a player. So like if I'm talking to a player about his hard hit rate, it's pretty intuitive, right? So maybe we're gonna like add half an ounce to his bat, and then as a result, we're gonna monitor his hard hit rate. But like pitch level data metrics, I'm probably not gonna go to a player with, or like any of the proprietary, every team has their own proprietary metrics that they calculate, so I'm probably not gonna say, oh, well, the Red Sox version of this says X, right? Because it's going to be a little bit over their heads. I want the message to be like as digestible and for them able to monitor as possible. So when they log onto their iPads, they can be like, oh, wow, my chase rate has gone down 15% this month. Like all of those metrics. And again, they're not dumb whatsoever. So they know baseball and they know certain things. But again, maybe not to the degree that the data scientists do.
I actually have two different questions. The first one is, in instances where you see tipping possibly, have you seen instances where the catcher might be contributing to the tipping of your pitcher?
Oh my God, absolutely. So like Francisco Alvarez, who was with the Mets last year in AA and is now with the Big League Club, like always stands up on fastballs that are at the top of the zone, right? Like 2 hours before the pitch is thrown. So like we always would be like, hey, Alvarez is behind the dish, like be aware, right? Because you can feel if there's someone behind you, if they're like giving up a low target maybe for a sinker, or if they're gonna elevate. So yeah, catchers absolutely need to be very mindful of their own tendencies.
And then my other question is, from a philosophical standpoint, because in the minor leagues it's more about development, how much were you guys willing to maybe change pitch selection or try and work on a new pitch in games during the year, as opposed to if they're at the major league level, they don't have the opportunity to do that?
Awesome question, yes. So I think at the major league level, it's always gonna be, what have you done for me lately? So there's not as long of a leash to work with pitchers. Hitters, the same thing if it's going through a swing change. But by the same token, I think the Red Sox did a decent job of conveying the importance of winning. Like, I think if you look at the minor league standings every year, the Rays almost consistently win each of their affiliate levels. And Brett Kennedy and I used to have great conversations about this. You don't just like suddenly turn it on one day when you get to Boston and say, okay, we're gonna win now. Like, it has to be instilled in you, it has to be developed, it has to be cultivated. So I would say we definitely were willing to experiment and to play around with things, but we also didn't want a guy at the end of the year to look back and be like, oh my God, I got shelled in every single outing because I was trying to work on this pitch that clearly didn't work. I think we tried to be very mindful of players' careers and their like lifelong numbers that they were gonna be kind of carrying with them if they went to a different team.
Hi there, first of all, thank you for being here. I appreciate what you're sharing, especially about the human side, because those 14-hour bus rides can't possibly be fun, and they also don't make a lot in the minors either. And I'm wondering, before I ask my other question, are you part of the consultation about who should be brought up to the majors in terms of scouting and that sort of thing?
Good question. We would have transition sheets. But I would say it was more so a conversation between Alex Cora and Chaim Bloom in the front office. So thinking about, who are we gonna put on the 40-man? You have to consider then who would be eligible in the Rule 5 draft that year, who you maybe could send down, the clubhouse dynamics, right? Like when I was with the Reds, there were a lot of big personalities. So whether it was Suarez or Moustakas or Joey, like Moose did not like the truncated playing time that he had. It absolutely affected the clubhouse. So I think being mindful of that too is something that they're like, they definitely have it top of mind.
Thank you. And one other thing you mentioned that is something that's had bothered me baseball-wise for a long time. I'm not a believer in swinging at the first pitch. I mean, last night's game, we saw a lot of people chasing, and I've seen a lot of rallies spike by swinging at the first pitch. And some might disagree with me about that, but it's like, I tell my math students, you want to hit a home run on your test and don't pop up on the first pitch. So I have a real gripe about that, and so I'm wondering if you might speak to that or anybody else. Thank you.
Definitely. I think that we have seen a lot of players who are super aggressive. Like Nico Horner won't walk a lot, but he absolutely knows what he's swinging at. I think like the 2009 Yankees absolutely embodied that, in that we're going to foul out a lot of pitches, we're going to get through your starting pitcher, and then we're just going to destroy your rotation. I think that that has to change a little bit now, because you have guys coming in out of the bullpen who are throwing just absolutely nasty stuff. So it's not necessarily like, oh, I'll just wait around until Josh Hader comes in and then I'll get my hits. So I would say I'm not, philosophically, I would prefer if the at-bats were longer, and it was one of the things I worked with the players on in the Cape, and that they had never seen a pitcher before, and they're swinging at the first pitch, they're not even like really thinking through the sequencing. But by the same token, if you get a mistake, if you get a slider over the plate, or if you get a fastball in the heart, you have to swing at it.
So as a practicing data scientist, I find myself having to explain analytic techniques to people who don't know how to calculate linear regression with a lot of simile and metaphor. Do you have any favorite ones that you've had to use with players or other staff who don't understand analytics the way you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I will name someone tangentially who once told me on the Red Sox that WOBA were fake numbers and ex-WOBA were hypothetical numbers. So there definitely was like a bit of a gap with some of the staff. And I think, you know, like the current Reds director of analytics was the chief data scientist at KFC, and he had to explain to a bunch of executives the difference between mean, median, and mode. So I think, you know, you have to be like pretty empathetic and not ever make anyone feel dumb. I think that it's like really easy to like laugh someone out of the room and be like, oh, like how could you possibly not know that? But by the same token, you know, the fact that they're even willing to come to you and ask the question, I think you have to have that psychological safety where they can do that.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you guys ever had to change signs based on trades or call-ups or call-downs, or like how that would work.
Really good question. So there were two guys we got from the Astros, and they actually, ironically, like didn't have a lot of work with player plans, which I find like quite fascinating. I think that they're like really adept at integrating data between the lines. But I would say that the signs change pretty regularly. Maybe that was why no one knew them. But we always tried to stay ahead of things. Like we would know upcoming series where we'd be facing coaches who were super adept, and so we'd be mindful of like not being lazy or letting things slip through the cracks.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Really appreciate it.